I'm Claudia Hammond, and today we're focusing on a single condition, a condition that can take over a person's life, preventing them from going out, from working, even from sleeping. The condition I'm talking about is anxiety, thought to affect around 1 in 14 people around the world at any given moment. The effects can be profound.
Rather than thinking, oh, I'm nervous, you think, I don't want to have a panic attack. And for me, I usually start thinking, I can't do this. What if somebody notices? What if I make a fool of myself? What if I end up in hospital? What if I end up on the streets? It escalates into something catastrophic, which isn't the reality, but those are the thoughts that go through my head rather than, oh, I might have a nice time, or this might be tricky, but it'll be okay. I'm thinking, I'm going to die.
Today we'll be looking at the causes of anxiety and the cures, and asking whether it's on the increase. My guest today is clinical psychologist Nick Gray from the Centre for Anxiety Disorders and Trauma at the Maudsley Hospital in London. So Nick, you see a lot of clients experiencing anxiety. Is it possible to define what it is?
I guess a reasonable definition would be that it's this kind of sort of feeling of worry, fear, nervousness that people would have about something that's got an uncertain outcome. It's a very sort of lay definition, I think.
Now, some people experiencing anxiety, like Scott Stossel, the editor of the American magazine The Atlantic, managed to keep it secret from their friends and colleagues. But in the end, his anxiety became so serious that he nearly missed his own wedding. As an author, he found publicity tours for his books so stressful that he decided to make anxiety the topic of his next, The Age of Anxiety, which of course has unfortunately resulted in another book tour. I asked him what anxiety feels like for him.
It can be more generalized feeling of worry, feeling of churning in the back of my mind, worrying about every conceivable negative outcome and sort of pessimistically anticipating the worst. That in some ways though is the milder form of anxiety. The most acute form comes in two different genres, I would say. One is just the sort of acute onset panic attack. You lose the ability to think straight and you start sweating and you have trouble, you're hyperventilating and you feel like you can't get enough breath and you feel as though your chest is constricting and you feel various forms of gastric distress. It can be quite terrifying and uncomfortable. You can have a similar sort of reaction in response to a phobic stimulus. So I have a number of specific phobias and, you know, for instance, flying, heights. And if I'm, you know, in an airplane, you can experience the symptoms that are basically akin to a panic attack. But in those cases, it's triggered directly by the thing that you fear.
Now, Nick, he mentions there the thing that you fear, and for him there seem to be quite a range of triggers. Is that unusual for people to have so many different phobias at one time?
No, I mean, what we find with people with anxiety problems is that there might be a kind of a range of fears that they have, but there's usually kind of one or two which are kind of most prominent and the kind of like the worst fears that they would have.
So is that different from, say, somebody having a phobia just of spiders? Would that count as anxiety still?
It definitely counts as anxiety. Anxiety is a normal process. It's something that I think we all have at one time or another and is important for us to, you know, kind of help keep us safe and help keep, you know, our loved ones safe as well. If we see our kids running into the road and there's a car coming, we'd feel anxious, and that's a good job that we do. I think what is less commonly the case is that people have this sort of disabling and chronic anxiety problem. I think that's what Scott's talking about. And I think the good news is that there are effective treatments for these now.
We will talk about those later. And anxiety is something we seem to hear a lot about these days. We like to talk about the stresses and strains of modern life and how much harder it all is now. But as part of his research, Scott Stossel has looked back in history and he's concluded that anxiety is nothing new.
Reading back through the historical literature, going back literally thousands of years, is that it seems like every age, whether that's each successive generation of the 20th century or going back to the Renaissance or going back to the late Roman Empire or even the 4th century BC in Greece, every age presumes to think that it is the most anxious age ever. You'll find physicians in the 2nd century AD Rome saying, you know, never have there been so many anxious, miserable, melancholic people, you know, through British history, the Victorian era, the Georgian era. And so you start to realize that clearly some quotient of anxiety is relatively fixed throughout the human population and endures and is part of the human condition. So some percentage of the people are going to be anxious all the time. But I do think, all that said, that certain eras are more productive of anxiety than others. And those tend to be eras like the Industrial Revolution or the Gilded Age or now, where you have rapid technological change, where the economy is uncertain, where you have rapid sort of social transformation and changing ideas of gender identity. And the feeling of uncertainty produces anxiety, can actually rewire your brain to be more anxious.
So, Nick, do we have any idea how many people do have anxiety disorders today? And would it be fair to say that they're on the rise or not?
I think the evidence is that actually they're not on the rise. Maybe we're talking about them more and there's perhaps a little less stigma in talking about them. I think the best evidence is the quote that you gave earlier on, which is about one in 14 people worldwide would sort of meet criteria for an anxiety disorder.
And is it fair to argue that it's something of a Western concept, and do anxiety disorders and the levels of those go up in countries as they become more westernised? Is it a Western construct in a way?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And unfortunately, there's not been kind of really enough research outside of kind of America, Western Europe and Australasia. The evidence that there is that actually the kind of those kind of like Western Europe, Anglophone countries have about a 20 to 50% more greater likelihood of meeting criteria for this kind of chronic anxiety than people from kind of sort of other cultures, kind of African cultures, kind of Indian, Asian cultures. But that might be to do with the way in which we're measuring anxiety, the questions that we're asking. What I don't know, and what I don't think the evidence is currently showing, is that as countries become perhaps more westernised or in that way, or perhaps more kind of affluent more generally, whether that leads to any increase in anxiety.
And then I suppose you don't know whether it would just be that more people are getting diagnosed. I mean, maybe that anxiety is there but doesn't get diagnosed because people don't have the opportunity to have it diagnosed, or maybe it isn't there.
Perhaps, but certainly in the kind of the studies that have got the kind of the best kind of evidence at the moment, they're not looking at people who have almost like the opportunity to be diagnosed. They are looking at kind of community studies. So they're kind of having researchers kind of ask people whether they're seeking treatment or not. So this isn't anything to do with the treatment seeking rates per se.
So what's interesting is what causes one person to experience extreme anxiety while another doesn't. Scott has noticed a phobia of vomiting running in his family.
My mother had that phobia fairly severely, and I had always thought that I'd acquired my phobia, they call it a metaphobia, from seeing her worries. So I took particular care, or at least tried to conceal my phobia from my daughter. And then a few years ago when she was 7 years old, which as it happens was the exact same age when I developed my phobia, give or take a few months, she started expressing it in very similar ways, which was both heartbreaking and fascinating to me, because it wouldn't seem that something as idiosyncratic as a metaphobia could be transmitted through the genes. So, I mean, my own conclusion based on, you know, the work of experts who study this regularly is that there is a very strong heritable component to one's predisposition to have an anxious temperament. But all that said, anxiety is not wholly reducible to genetics. You know, I think that lays the basis for your propensity to be anxious. But then on top of that, there is your upbringing, your life circumstances, your life, whether you're subjected to trauma, and a certain component of luck.
So it's that age-old question that we always face in psychology of how much is it down to the environment and how much is it down to genetic factors. Is there evidence that anxiety can be heritable, or is it just that we copy what we see in other people? So, you know, Scott sees his mother and sees that she doesn't like vomiting.
I think Scott summarised it really nicely. I'm not sure that I'd add anything to that other than just summarise there is a genetic propensity to have, say, an anxious temperament, and then it's the life experiences and traumatic events and the things that you observe that then determine how that kind of plays out or not.
And there do seem to be certain things that we're more likely to have phobias of, aren't there? Like snakes and spiders, and not everyone's afraid of them, but more people are. And monkeys, for example, are, say, afraid of snakes as well.
Yeah, and there's kind of sort of a hypothesis from sort of kind of basic psychology around kind of preparedness, that there are some things that we're kind of perhaps in an evolutionary term more prepared to develop kind of phobias to, such as the things which can immediately kind of cause us harm, dangerous animals. Things like kind of vomit phobia would be about kind of disgust, making sure the germs kind of aren't inside us. But then it's other phobias can develop really kind of following kind of traumatic events. So we can develop an anxiety response to almost kind of any stimulus if it's associated with a kind of a traumatic experience that we've had.
And you mentioned evolution there, and Scott points out that we have all evolved to feel a degree of anxiety.
Darwin talked about how species that fear rightly enhance their chances of survival. And if nobody felt fear, if you didn't have the fight or flight response, if we as a species that hadn't been bequeathed to us by evolution, we probably would have gone extinct long ago. So some quotient of anxiety is highly adaptive. But I think for many people, and particularly people with anxiety disorders, there can be a gap between the public presentation of competence and confidence and the internal sense of imposter syndrome, feeling like you're inadequate. So everybody struggles with a little bit of anxiety, but people who have acute anxiety disorders, and many people are quite good at hiding it. And that leads to, what one therapist I talked to calls impression management, where you're always in mortal terror of the vulnerable, anxious self within being revealed, which in itself becomes kind of a contributor to the anxiety because you're trying so hard to keep that inner vulnerable, anxious, imposter self from being revealed that you have to put all this work into maintaining your external impression or your brand. And that's both a symptom and a cause of additional anxiety.
Nick, I wonder whether this is something you recognize in your clients. Do you see this sort of desperation to maintain a public face and to not have people know about it and to keep that anxiety secret?
I think it's very true of many of the people that we see. And I think it's particularly true of those people who have kind of problems with sort of social anxiety disorder, where their worst fears are about kind of showing signs of anxiety or saying or doing something that would be embarrassing or humiliating, and then other people thinking badly of them.
Well, our reporter Lynn Ginsberg has been to meet Claire, who has social anxiety disorder, which she thinks was brought on by her job.
So I'm in the park with Claire, who's agreed to meet me, just outside of work. And this is a situation that maybe a couple of years ago would not have been so pleasant. Claire, can you tell us why that might be?
Well, 18 months ago, I was dealing with a very bad period of anxiety, well, severe anxiety and panic attacks. And I'm right outside my office, which is where most of it takes place. So, yeah, a couple of years ago, this wouldn't have been a particularly nice place for me to be. I'd want to be as far away as possible.
And what kind of events in your office would make you feel anxious?
Well, I work in an office with very strong characters, which doesn't necessarily mean they're bad people. It just means they're a lot louder than me, more expressive than I am. And I put a lot of pressure on myself to sort of compete and conform. It actually relates back to school in many ways for me, because I felt the same way in classrooms. Like, I need to be like these people. I can't be like myself. I need to be like this. And the pressure to be like that eventually made me ill, unfortunately.
And when did you realise that that was the case, that you were reacting to these situations that are stressful for everyone in a different way and in a way that needed to be managed?
It was starting to keep me up at night, I noticed. It was little things at first, sort of meetings or presentations where I had to say something, and then eventually it spiraled into I wasn't sleeping at all because I was so worried about it, and I was worried about speaking to certain people in the office and certain things. Like, I developed quite a bad tremor and heart palpitations, difficulty breathing, all the sort of common side effects of anxiety, really.
Now, Nick, I thought it was interesting there that Claire compares her competitive work environment today with being at school and says it feels a bit like that. When you're talking to clients about their anxiety, how much would you talk to them about their past as well?
Certainly kind of where the evidence is in treating anxiety disorders, it's trying to work on what's keeping the problem going now. As part then of, as we go on in treatment, and think about how we can try and prevent the anxiety kind of recurring. And I think that's probably when we talk much more about perhaps kind of the origins of it and how it may be that people are reacting to situations in the adult world now, which are actually just an echo or ghost of the kind of like earlier experiences, such as at school.
Do you ever find that clients sometimes can see this upside, even though it can be so disabling for them?
I've got to say, I think in the kind of the health clinics in which I'm working, there are very few upsides to experiencing kind of chronic anxiety, although I can see there may be upsides to the kind of the normal process of kind of worry or fear. I think the one area perhaps where people can have some kind of form of almost like personal growth from overcoming adversity or seeing that they can have perhaps kind of greater levels of empathy and compassion for others who are also kind of experiencing difficulties. But certainly most of the people that we're seeing would say that their kind of chronic anxiety disorder is really a negative thing and they want to kind of be rid of it as far as is possible.
Yes, because I guess actually experiencing a chronic anxiety disorder is different from just a touch of perfectionism, say.
I'd think so, yeah.
Claire, who we heard from earlier, has tried a range of different treatments.
I now take a mild antidepressant called sertraline, which is an SSRI inhibitor.
So a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, is that right?
That's the one. And so I take that, and I also did a course of cognitive behavioural therapy, which helped me to retrain my brain by neutralising the negative thoughts that I have with more rational ones. I exercise a lot. I go to the gym 3 times a week to keep my adrenaline levels down in a healthy way. And the biggest one for me actually is what I call exposure therapy, whereby I slowly put myself in situations that make me uncomfortable in order to retrain my amygdala in my brain not to go off every time I'm in that situation in future, because there is no danger. I'm always going to be a little bit nervous, but for me it was accepting that being nervous is a completely natural emotion. It's not a symptom of a bigger problem. People get nervous before interviews and people get nervous before they meet new people. That's 100% fine, and it's just about accepting that feeling but doing it anyway, because it might be fun and it's never as bad as you think it's going to be.
Scott too has come to terms with the fact that he's never going to be entirely free from anxiety, but that he can manage it.
I may never be cured, but I can come to terms with the anxiety and recognize that it is an acceptable part of who I am and comes with certain elements of my personality that may be favorable. There are many things that I have, therapies and techniques that I've used that do help. Certain medications help a lot in certain circumstances, and obviously, you know, medication works in different ways for different people, but SSRI antidepressants and benzodiazepines, which are the class of sort of minor tranquilizer, help a lot with severe anxiety. I've, mindfulness meditation, I've not probably explore that enough myself, but there's lots of evidence that that can be highly, highly effective in literally reshaping your brain, you know, strengthening the rational part of your brain and literally shrinking the amygdala, which is the seat of fear. So there's a lot of evidence that that works. And then many psychiatrists will say there are, you know, if you're in the throes of a panic attack or if you're feeling overwhelmed, do breathing exercises to help yourself calm down. And then any doctor or dietitian or psychiatrist will tell you sleep is incredibly important, regular exercise is incredibly important, and cultivating what the psychiatrists today talk about, resilience, which is a trait that, you know, makes you resistant to developing anxiety and depression. And resilience, too, is thought to be somewhat encoded into your genes, but it's also something that can be learned. The military is studying how can they make soldiers, the U.S. military, make their soldiers more resilient so that they're resistant to breaking down with PTSD after combat. So cultivating a resilient, optimistic outlook is probably one of the more effective things you can do to mitigate anxiety.
Now, Nick, trying to accept your anxiety as part of you, you know, sounds like very good advice, but is it easier said than done when it feels so unpleasant?
Yeah, I think it is easier said than done. I think there are also things that people do with the best of intentions that actually serve to keep the anxiety going. And I think one of the things that kind of the effective treatments do is to try and identify what those kind of maintaining sort of factors are, and then to try and help change those.
What sort of things might someone do that maintain it?
Well, the kind of things really similar to kind of like Scott and Claire have mentioned is that people do things to try and prevent the worst from happening. So if your heart's racing very, very fast and you think you're going to have kind of a heart attack or you're going to pass out, it makes sense to sit down or to try and take the weight off your feet, do some breathing exercises to kind of to calm your breathing down, because you have this belief that otherwise you're going to die. The problem is, of course, is that whilst a panic attack is very frightening and feels awful, it's not in fact dangerous. Yeah, and one of the things that these precautions, these things to save yourself, do is you never learn that if you didn't do these kind of precautions, that actually you'd still be okay. So one of the things that kind of the most effective treatments do, and these are in anxiety typically cognitive behaviour therapy, is to help people learn that some of these things they do to save themselves are probably unnecessary.
So is that where Claire was talking about exposure therapy and gradually getting used to the things that she fears?
Yeah, partly. And actually, certainly for people with social anxiety disorder, it's kind of moved really kind of beyond pure exposure therapy now. And it's really looking at not just you know, exposing yourself and kind of grinning and holding on to kind of, you know, the nearest chair until the anxiety passes. But it's really looking at what your predictions are. What do you think's going to happen, and how can you kind of really kind of test that out? And also in kind of social anxiety, one of the things that happens is that people often try to kind of hide their anxiety, something that I think Scott mentioned. And one of the things that trying to hide your anxiety or trying to kind of manage your image does is it actually makes you more self-focused, more self-conscious. And if you're kind of more self-conscious and self-focused, you're not really paying attention to what's going on out there. You're not paying attention to how people are really reacting to you. So it may feel as though some of your fears are coming true, but the reality may not be, that may not be the case. One of the things that we would do as part of treatment, actually, for people with social anxiety disorder is actually to video record them as part of treatment. And
that sounds horrible.
It's certainly anxiety provoking, right. But of course, yeah. One of the things about it being anxiety provoking is that then their fears are activated, their fears of whether they're looking shaky or whether they fear that they're going red or fear that they're saying something stupid. And how it feels to them at that moment, they can then compare with how it actually looks on the video. And one of the things that certainly we kind of find in treatment is that, you know, almost always people are surprised by how they look and how they sound on video compared to how it felt to them.
So even though they might be cringing at the beginning, it's still not actually as bad as what they were imagining.
Absolutely. And one of the things we guide people to do is to look at it as if they were watching TV, as if they were watching somebody else, rather than busy criticising themselves when they're watching it. But just to kind of see it as if as somebody else would. And then usually it's the case that what they're seeing, what they're hearing is very different to how it felt at the time.
And sometimes you're using imagery in your work as well. What's that and how would that work?
Yeah, and this is certainly something that's kind of been a development over the last kind of 10 or 15 years in anxiety disorders, that some of the worst fears that people have aren't just kind of like a verbal thought like I'm going to die or people can see I'm looking red, but they have an image of either how they're coming across, they have an image of themselves looking red in the face, they have an image of themselves kind of looking anxious, or they may have an image of themselves actually kind of collapsed in the street from a panic attack. Certainly a person that I treated with panic disorder some time ago, he actually had an image of a blood clot moving around his body. And the fear of this then kind of reaching his heart. So when his heart was racing, he feared that this blood clot that he had in this image was going to stop his heart.
And so after people have had some sort of treatment, like possibly medication, as Claire and Scott were talking about, or cognitive behavioural therapy like this, what sort of outcomes do you see? How easy is it to actually rid people of their anxiety?
I don't think we rid people of anxiety. I don't think we ever aim to rid people of anxiety. And if people come in with the goal of saying, I never want to be anxious again, yeah, we need to have a kind of a discussion around actually the normality of fear and worry and anxiety and what's kind of realistic in those terms.